303-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer tonight is Althea Billings. The director of Evening News is also Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Erin J. Bernard.
And I'm Nat Moon. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Voices from the Edge, progressive talk radio with a grassroots perspective, hosted by Joanne Hardesty. At 9, it's Press Watch, where Teresa Mitchell brings you news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30, it's Fight the Empire, where Per Fagerang connects history with current events. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Between the Covers, featuring interviews with locally and nationally known authors. Then at 11:30, it's Express Yourself, hosted by G and featuring talented spoken word artists, rappers, poets, and singers from around the Portland area. KBOO is an independent, non-commercial, community radio station powered by our volunteers and our members. By making a donation through GiveGuide on kboo.fm/give, you're eligible for more than $4,000 of free and discounted products from your favorite Portland brands. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
Stay tuned for Culture in Motion, coming up next.
Good evening. You are listening to Culture in Motion, your twice monthly show on KBOO Community Radio, KBOO.FM or 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Michael Crenshaw, and this is Culture in Motion, and I'm here at the Caldera Arts Camp. Give thanks to the Caldera Foundation and organization. And I have a very special guest, Carolyn Hopkins. Carolyn, welcome.
Thanks
for joining us on Culture in Motion. So you've got, I was mentioning to you that this radio show is about the intersection of art, culture, politics, social movements.
Yeah.
And you responded, there's work that you're doing as an artist that seems to have themes that are reflecting on environmental crises and where we're at as a human race. So can you tell us a little bit about your medium and yeah. what's behind what you do?
Yeah, I grew up in Central Oregon and Portland. So I was born and raised in Oregon and lived in Central Oregon during a time of rapid development. The city was expanding really rapidly and my mom was an urban use planner. So she worked a lot on kind of trying to be more conscious about urban growth and how we were affecting things around us. And I had a lot of really early experiences with wildlife and kind of not realizing really where those were coming from, but finding things like California quail nests that had been abandoned, trying to hatch those eggs.
Oh, wow.
And thinking, you know, that would be great to have wildlife as a pet. But as I got older, I started working within the park system. I worked in Grand Teton National Park for a number of years as an interpretive trail guide on horseback, and really started becoming more aware of what preservation means, how that looks, whether that's even something that we're capable of in terms of preserving a space or a species or a landscape. And at that time I had moved to Kansas City and was in going to art college. And so a lot of that stuff kind of started moving into my studio practice in terms of the things that I was concerned about. Mm-hmm. And so I spent a few years in New York City after that and kind of moved around all over and ended up going to graduate school right outside of Detroit, Michigan.
Okay.
And so my work has always been very concerned with sort of the role we play within an ecosystem, whether that's a smaller ecosystem or something specific or globally. And for a long time, a lot of my work used a lot of animal imagery, taxidermy forms. I would upholster taxidermy forms to kind of talk about that intersection. And more recently, I've kind of been moving away from that and trying to look at different kinds of iconography and different kinds of ways of talking about the similar subject matter. And I think kind of in the past few years especially, there's been a rising anxiety about where we're headed and how rapidly global warming is becoming a large crisis. So my work has become more and more focused kind of on that anxiety or sense of doom or sense of hope. And, you know, different people have different perspectives on whether we're at a point where we can salvage the mess we've made or whether it's gone too far, and how that's going to affect different ecosystems and also different peoples. Because as things become worse, there's going to be issues in terms of water and food, etc. So now I'm using a lot more imagery using human bones rather than using animal imagery.
So you work with bones. That's one of the mediums you work in. You talked about taxidermy.
Mm-hmm.
So there's these intersections between life, death, and the natural world.
Yeah.
How long you've been doing that since you were a child?
I would say a little bit. I think I became really conscientious of that material choice around my early 20s.
Okay.
And for the most part, I don't use actual bones or actual skins or actual material. I usually, like right now, I'm working with two whale bones that I took molds off of the whale bones so that I could cast them in different material. So I often use traditional craft medium in my practice, kind of as a stand-in, but also to talk about different historical references and to have an entirely different conversation in terms of the type of medium I'm choosing to use to execute the work.
So part of me, if you already said this and I missed it, but what for listeners who are curious or interested, what would you call your medium?
Oh, yeah, I mean, I'm definitely a contemporary artist in terms of medium. I don't have one thing that I use. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of times my work comes out as sculptural mm-hmm. work. So I'll use different objects or materials or things that I've made together. I do some amount of 2D work, so drawing, not so much painting. And then most recently, I've been using pressed flowers to make imagery.
Mm-hmm.
So those pieces will be in an upcoming exhibition. I usually end up having some amount of 2D work along with the sculptural work.
Okay, 2D as in two-dimensional?
Yeah,
not 2D fruity. Gotcha.
On paper,
gotcha.
Yeah.
Right, I get you. And has your work centered mostly around the local environment in the Northwest and Portland, where you live and where you're from? Have you done work on a global level or even on a national level outside of this region?
Yeah, I think, you know, the work has mostly been North America centric.
Yeah.
Especially because I have always resided here. It's sort of what I'm familiar with and what I'm around. And earlier on, I was also, you know, taxidermy and kind of this idea of mounting things or using them as trophies is a very American way of interacting with wildlife.
Mm.
I would say now it's a little more focused on a global scale, like using replicas of human bones and whale bones. I'm kind of thinking about larger crises that are happening.
And the work you do, I find there's often a disconnect between the concept of being a professional artist
mm-hmm.
and the concept of being an activist.
Right.
Right? And to me, my work intersects.
Yeah.
You know, my art and my activism definitely intersects. Can you talk a little bit about the intersection between the work you do,
mm-hmm.
The reality of what you're looking at
mm-hmm.
with climate crises, environmental crises, and activism?
Yeah. I think especially in the Northwest, I think there's it's hard actually to find artists that aren't having a component of that in their work, because visual art is usually a cultural critique in some way. You're reacting to something that's going on or that you're seeing or that's influencing your life or your practice. I think it's really hard oftentimes to even separate those two. So for me, you know, I've always been concerned about our global position in terms of the way that we are using natural resources, polluting, creating a situation where the climate is actually becoming too warm for us to inhabit. And the way that I am most successful communicating those things is through my artwork. When people see my work, oftentimes there's an element of humor or an element of seduction that I think can captivate someone enough to kind of start interacting with the work intellectually until they reach a point where they realize that it's a critique or commentary on some of these issues, and trying to kind of rehash the stuff that we're talking about on a day-to-day basis. Like, I log into Facebook today and there's an article that pops up about how lightning bugs are now maybe going to go extinct. And I think we're constantly seeing all of that now, and it's easy to kind of put it in your back pocket or put it to the back of your mind and maybe not be thinking about it all the time. So if I can bring some of that subject matter back into somebody's day-to-day interaction with my artwork or what they're doing in their own life, then I've started a dialogue about something that's important to me that I want people to be thinking about.
That's really admirable. I think about lightning bugs often, because when I grew up in the Midwest, they were so prevalent.
Yeah.
I remember we used to catch jars full of them, you know, and I also remember them being so plentiful that I noticed that when you, you know, when you're stationary, they look yellow or, or Gatorade green or whatever, but when you're driving by them or you're moving by them, they actually look blue.
Oh, wow.
And that's an experience that I got to have growing up there.
Yeah.
I don't know where on earth people get to have that same experience, because they are almost gone. Another thing that I took note of was that my brother's daughter drove from Minnesota to Portland last summer. And when she got here, my brother said he noticed that her car barely had any dead insects on it.
Oh, wow.
Which was a weird way to understand the vanishing insect population, because I do remember driving across the country, you know, in the summertime or even in the spring or fall, and how many bugs you would hit.
Absolutely.
You know, and they're talking about 3 billion birds. So thank you for, you know, just doing what you're doing. And I think that these things, like you said, are things that we tend to want to push out of our minds or ignore. But being able to engage that with the work that you do.
Right.
Where do you see things headed in, say, 5, 10 years? And how much do you feel like your work is, like, integral to shaping that?
I mean, I'm not optimistic. I'm very... I do think we're at a point where there's a lot of people paying a lot more of attention, being a lot louder about things, which makes me a little more hopeful. I also, you know, I think we're good at inventing technologies to solve problems. So, you know, hopefully we can come up with some solutions that way. But really, there has to be an enormous change about the way that we live daily. And I think that affects everyone on a really small scale, but it also affects communities on a much larger scale. Even, you know, I have an aunt in California who's evacuated her home twice in the past 2 years because there were fires very near her house. And kind of looking at these little microcosms of the ways that these things can inconvenience or devastate our lives is becoming something that people seem to be paying more attention to. Things are happening on a scale and happening more rapidly than they used to be happening. And that, I think, is causing a lot of people to kind of finally stand up and say this is something that is a primary concern for me. And when they go to vote or when they, you know, go to donate money, I think a lot more people are focused on those issues. And I think the other thing is that we also have to start looking at them as humanitarian issues. It's not just about wanting to save a species of animal. It's about the reality of, you know, thousands of people are not going to be able to be living where they are now, and how that's going to affect larger scale immigration, people moving and becoming, you know, climate refugees. All of that is really scary. So I think in the next 5 to 10 years, unfortunately, there's going to be a lot more devastation in terms of larger hurricanes, bigger forest fires, especially in our region. You know, it's becoming a much bigger problem here. And hopefully those things spark outrage and spark movement in people to try to get more attention and try to make change. It's just such a large issue. It's hard to know, you know, where we're headed and how we're going to fix that problem or if we're capable. So it is something that I have a lot of anxiety about personally as well.
Thank you for bringing it back to your personal sensation and experience, because that's what I struggle with. And I think mm-hmm. a lot of times talking about these issues, especially when we listen to mainstream media,
yeah.
we tend to talk about them in terms that are actually separate from our own experience.
Right.
And I think the anxiety that I feel
mm-hmm.
Is a reflection of my awareness
mm-hmm.
and this sense that, like, I have to do something. And that's what this brings me, you know, it's a dark thing to consider. But, like,
yeah.
we have on one side of the spectrum this more hopeful, proactive approach. Like, there's mm-hmm. something we can do if enough people do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also this darker kind of nihilistic understanding that's sometimes seems like a practical worldview,
yeah.
right?
Right.
And so the question becomes, like as artists, like, and that's why I ask you the question, where do you see us headed? How do you cope with the nihilistic side that's not promising?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have an anxiety issue. You know, I try to exercise and be really aware of how that affects me. There's now a word for anxiety that comes from climate change, and it's solastalgia.
Solastalgia.
Uh-huh. And I've seen it a few places now, and it's starting to be a word that's used more widely to describe that kind of feeling of hopelessness or anxiety about what's going to happen. And I mean, for me, on a very personal level, it's a question of, am I going to have children? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm kind of in an age where I have to make that decision, and a lot of my friends have had kids, and I want to have them, but I'm also really worried about what the world is going to look like in 20 years. It's a very difficult thing some days to deal with, and other days I just, you know, enjoy my life and go outside and go hiking and go horseback riding and kind of enjoy the way things are now. But it's always in the back of my mind that, especially growing up in Oregon, that these landscapes may look very different, you know, 20 to 30 years from now. And also, you know, we're going to have a lot of people moving here because we have good fresh water. We have a relatively secure food system here, which, you know, and as we look towards how things are going to change, it looks like for a while that will be secure. So also just thinking about, I own property in Portland. Do I keep that property? Do I hold on to it? Do I stay there? Portland's growing really rapidly. And kind of thinking about how to position myself so that I have a safe place to live 40 years from now.
I'm going to follow up on this in a second. But for the listeners who want to know where to find your work,
mm-hmm.
Is there a place they can find it online and look at it?
And
also, do you have some upcoming shows?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So my website is my name, which is Carolyn with a Y-N, A-N-N Hopkins, .com. And then I am also part of a co-op that I kind of spearheaded founding about a year and a half ago, and that's called Carnation Contemporary. It's in the Disjecta building in the Kitten neighborhood of Portland. And that project was really a reaction to feeling like there weren't a lot of opportunities for many visual artists that I knew in Portland who were not showing, and really feeling like we had an opportunity to open an artist-run space so that we could show our own work, have a venue, to really do whatever we wanted. And I had been a member of an artist-run space up in Seattle that had been really successful that had closed. And so using some Seattle galleries kind of as models for what we were doing, we opened Carnation. And we started with about 14 members, and we have an open call right now for new folks to join. We also have an open call for a group show. So we're starting to get the wheels going in terms of becoming more established and getting a little bit more attention. And getting people through the door. But I have a show opening there January 4th called Sirens, which is a lot of the work is kind of dealing with the subject matter and has a lot of odd imagery. There's a lot of human skulls involved, some whale bones, and some other things that I'll leave to be surprises.
Awesome. So Carolyn with a Y, Ann Hopkins, .com. And then if artists want to get in touch with the space, that's at Disjecta. What's the name of that?
It's Carnation Contemporary. Okay. And if you Google that or just type it in .com, there's an opportunities page on the website. Mm-hmm. And so you can go there to get more information about membership or the curated group show who is being curated by Michael Endo, who's an artist who just moved down to Joshua Tree and started some projects down there.
Mm-hmm. So the work you do with skulls, I love skulls. You said human skulls. Are you dealing with cast or are you dealing with... Okay.
So I work a lot from molds. For the human skull pieces, I actually ordered a mold that was made... presumably from a real skull at some point. And then I just basically use that as a press mold to press clay into. And that way, each of the pieces comes out looking a lot different from one another. And then through kind of altering the pieces or removing parts of them, they become each a unique piece that is made from the same mold.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so we've talked about a lot, and there, I want to circle back to a couple of things. I'm sorry if I seem heavy-handed about
this. No, no worries.
The art and activism. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something I struggle with as an artist that's also an activist, is there's seeming contradiction between being somebody that serves the community, which often activists are noted or seen to be doing, and artists. And there's this idea that artists are a little bit more self-serving.
Right, yeah.
And not connected to what's really going on. Mm-hmm. A lot of the people I look up to as activists, some of them are also artists. But something that sticks with me is this notion that you can't do it by yourself.
Yeah, absolutely.
You have to do it with others. You have to be organized with others. Mm-hmm. What do you have to say? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, especially with the co-op, that space is completely artist-run. So when I was looking, you know, to find folks to do this project with me, I was just reaching out to visual artists that I knew that might have a vague interest, and then really relying on them to step up and, you know, help me make it happen. And when you start reaching out like that and you take an idea that maybe was yours to begin with, it's amazing to see what happens when a community is built around that idea and propels it forward. And it's no longer about your authorship, right? It's about giving other people a space and an opportunity to show their work. And just in the 18 months we've kind of existed as a group, we've had opportunities to bring in other people from different places to show their work. We've had artists who've used their month to curate shows and, you know, show artists from all over the U.S. So it's really interesting to watch that project kind of take on its own life because of other people who are getting involved. And then in terms of my own kind of personal life, I have worked with Caldera for years now and do weekend workshops and then have taught at camp before and really enjoy that kind of work as well. And I've also opened up my personal studio to teach workshops and kind of share my material knowledge with community members around me.
Okay.
I can get a little hermity, especially if I'm working on a project. But, you know, the things that I've done that have been the most rewarding are definitely projects where I've involved other people, like Carnation.
Yeah. And how important is it to you in your practice and coming up with the time to be inspired enough to visualize what your projects are going to be? How important is it for you to have solitude and time away from everybody?
That's gotten more important as I've gotten older. I think when I was younger and I was in school, I socialized a lot. And I would go backpacking and spend some amount of time by myself. But as I've gotten older, I really need a lot more time alone to process not just my day-to-day life, but ideas take much longer for me now. I kind of sit on them for a long time. There's many visual artists that make things every day, and I'm not that type of visual artist.
Yeah.
And I also had a lot of guilt around that for a long time, because in art school, it's like you make things every day. You have to be productive. And it took me a long time to realize that the way I work, my ideas kind of have to sit with me for much longer. So it's something where I'm much more aware of getting time alone on a daily basis, but also making time for something like this, a residency, where you get to get out of your daily life, kind of push aside all of those responsibilities and just make time that's really for you to dig into some of your ideas and make a mess and have failures and figure stuff out, which can be hard to do, you know, when you're working in an 8-to-5 or having other life things happen.
Real talk, I've only recently in the last couple of years found access to residencies and really grateful for the opportunity.
Yeah.
How long have you been engaged in that?
I'm lucky. I think because I went, you know, to art college, I was made very aware of that very early on. And Caldera was actually the second residency I ever did as a 22-year-old. So it's always been a priority for me, which has made employment difficult.
Right.
And it's only been in the past 2 years, you know, I was fortunate enough to buy a house in Portland before things got crazy and then leveraged that into buying a larger property a little further out that has a big studio space.
Yeah, you mentioned horseback riding.
I don't own a horse. I don't have enough property for a horse, but I do have goats.
Right.
So having that space where I can kind of have solitude away from everyone else is really important to me.
Yeah. Lastly, I want to ask you, and thank you for talking to us on Culture in Motion today.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it. Can we solve the issues we face as a civilization under capitalism?
Oh God, I don't think so. I think we are due for a change. I mean, if you just look at the way things have been going for the past 50, 100 years, past 15 years, it's the problems that we have are really rooted in this economical battle for people to have money and resources. And there is not a concern, or a big enough concern, from the people who are kind of running the show for the, you know, impending climate disaster. And I really do think that there has to be a large shift globally, especially in the United States, in terms of the way we share resources and how our economy functions.
Thank you for talking to me and to our listeners on KBOO. And this has been Culture in Motion. You're listening to Carolyn Hopkins again, carolynannhopkins.com.
Yep.
One love, y'all. Peace.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, the time, 5:58. Coming up next is going to be Rural Roots Rising.
KBOO is an independent, member-supported, non-commercial, volunteer-powered community radio station. By making a donation through GiveGuide on kboo.fm/give, you're eligible for over $4,000 worth of free and discounted products from your favorite Portland brands. Also want to let folks know that in the past half hour, the House has voted to impeach Trump on 2 counts, on abuse of power and obstruction of Congress connected to a Ukraine pressure campaign, making President Trump the 3rd sitting president in history to be impeached. Coming up next, Rural Roots Rising.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue unless otherwise noted. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday at 4:30 p.m. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the SJAC Holiday Fundraiser and Open Hours Launch Party on Sunday, December 29th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Social Justice Action Center in Portland. The Social Justice Action Center provides community space, access to a commercial kitchen, and now new open hours. The launch party will provide information about new programs, opportunities to volunteer, and more. Again, that's the SJAC Holiday Fundraiser and Open Hours Launch Party on Sunday, December 29th at the Social Justice Action Center, 400 Southeast 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to Rural Roots Rising by the Rural Organizing Project, a monthly podcast created by and for rural Oregonians who are creatively and courageously building stronger and more vibrant communities for a just democracy. Today we are going to talk about rural community building. We will hear from Martha Verduzco from Hood River County and Katie Cook from Gillam County about how their communities need